11 minutes past 9 o'clock. Welcome back to the second and final hour of our weekly FIQH Q&A program. And in this segment, we will be joined by Mufti Muhammad Hafiji, who's from Jamiatul Ulama South Africa Economics Desk. And inshallah, he's going to discuss with us the conscious consumer and some tips or business for beginners he's going to share with us. But before we start, firstly, we welcome Mufti Muhammad Hafiji on the line all the way from Mayfair West. Mufti Sahab, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Mulana Suhaib, and all the listeners of Radio Islam. Jazakallah for having me once again, Mulana.
Jazakallah for availing yourself. How are you doing this evening?
Alhamdulillah, through Allah Ta'ala's grace and mercy, Mulana. Happy to be with you and with all the listeners once again.
We are looking forward to, inshallah, benefit from your vast experience as far as economics is concerned, both Islamically as well as normal up-to-date that you have and news that you keep us up-to-date with that. We are looking forward for that.
Inshallah, the feeling is mutual.
Mufti Sahab, we commence by asking you regarding lease agreements. Can you dispense with some advice on the minimum requirements of lease agreements?
Indeed, I'll try my best, Moana. You know, in the aftermath of the COVID-19 lockdown in South Africa, I don't know if we can really call it an aftermath because it feels like we're still undergoing quite a state of COVID-19 itself. But with it said, many cash-strapped homeowners are trying to let out any space they may have in order to make ends meet. But whether an individual is a tenant or a landlord in this type of situation, one should always be sure that that rental agreement is cast in writing. Or ensuring that a rental agreement is cast in writing is not only a requirement of the Rental Housing Act, but this is the best way to probably avoid confusion or any future disputes about the terms of the rental agreement itself. Over and above that, the most important and fundamental aspect of having a rental agreement cast in writing is that there are Sharia grounds and Islamic grounds which are firmly entrenched in the Quran in terms of ensuring that our agreements are put to writing. So in response to your question, I'm just going to provide a few basic tips for individuals who may be considering letting out some space of theirs in order to accrue some basic revenue there. Before I do that, the first thing I want to say, Morana, is that one of the most important things landlords can consider is making sure that they run a basic credit reference or even an ordinary reference check on any prospective tenant. Obviously, this would need to be done with a written permission, but before allowing the individual to take occupation of any part of the property, it is important to ensure that there's some kind of reference check or even a credit check on the individual. This could be done in a very simple way. The landlord could simply request the tenant to provide a credit report from any one of the six credit providers or credit bureaus in the country. As I've mentioned previously, every individual, every citizen is entitled to one free credit report per year. Now, if you think of six credit bureaus, that's basically six free credit report for every citizen in the country. So that's one way in which a landlord can eliminate the prospect of having a tenant who is not able to pay or service the rental agreement. So that's one important aspect to keep in mind. Remember, it's much better to turn someone with a poor credit profile away or a poor payment record down at the very beginning than to have to go through the time-consuming and very costly process of evicting someone who has defaulted on rent. So that's the first thing. The second thing, and to make things even easier, it is worthwhile considering employing or letting out premises through a qualified and experienced managing agent who is affiliated to a reputable agency. This will, in this way, one will be able to provide a standard written lease agreement, which is provided by these agents, and this agreement will clearly set out all the terms and conditions of the agreement and all the rights and responsibilities of each party, the landlord and the tenant. If anyone is unable to do this and unable to utilize the services of a reputable agency, then here are just a few basic tips to keep in mind for that lease document. And the very bare minimum that the lease document would need to take into account in terms of the lease agreement. So the first aspect and the minimum requirement is the contact details of both the landlord and the tenant, including their phone numbers and their emergency numbers. So that's the first thing in terms of minimum requirements of the agreement. If any landlord is not utilizing an agency or a rental agency for that matter. The second important thing is to ensure that the address or the physical address and the description of the property or space being rented is provided or included in the agreement in writing. The third aspect is the details of any deposit paid, the monthly rental amount, and even the proposed duration of the tenancy. These three elements, I'm mentioning them together, should all form part of the written lease agreement. So in point number three, I'm referring to the deposit as one item, the monthly rental amount that will be applicable for the duration of lease, the proposed duration of the tenancy, and obviously if the duration is fixed, there would also be a need to highlight the rate at which rentals per month would escalate, and that would need to be cast in writing if possible. And then the fourth aspect is the landlord and tenant responsibilities and requirements with regards to maintenance and security, for example. This should also form part of the lease agreement as a minimum requirement. And then point number five is the procedures and a notice required to cancel the lease or to renew the lease. This is also one of the minimum requirements of a lease agreement. And then the last one I want to make mention of is a list of the existing property defects compiled in a joint inspection that both parties go through the place and detect whatever defects there are, put them in writing and make sure that these all form part of the written lease agreement. So just as a summary, Mullen, I'm just going to refer to the basic elements of a lease agreement. Number one is the contact details of both landlord and tenant, including the phone numbers and emergency numbers. Number two is the aspect of the address, physical address, and the description of the property being rented. Number three is the details of any deposit paid, the monthly rental amount, and the proposed duration of the tenancy. And then number four was the aspect of landlord and tenant responsibilities and requirements with regard to maintenance and security, for example. The fifth aspect was the aspect of the procedures and the notice required to cancel the lease or even to renew the lease. And the last aspect was the list of existing property defects that may be prevalent in the property before taking occupation. So for the sake of clarity, the lease should also detail what is to be done with the deposit or if a tenant has to put down a deposit. And ideally, from a Sharia perspective, it should be kept in mind that that amount belongs to the tenant. If it is utilized by the landlord, this can only be done if there is permission granted by the tenant for the landlord to utilize the deposit. Many a time we see cases where landlords make use of deposited funds, and then when it comes to having to return that deposit, they are unable to do so. So from a Sharia perspective, even if that deposit is placed into a bank account or invested, it is invested on behalf of the tenant for the tenant's benefit, and at the end of the lease period, there will be deductions from there for any damages in case of any damages being caused to the property. Any of the balance then would have to be returned to the tenant. So this in a nutshell, and I hope I've responded to your question by providing some basic advice of the minimum requirements for lease agreement.
Yes, indeed. You have the justice to that, Mufti Saab. We move on further. Is there a difference between contingency and emergency fund? And are there basic tips that to offer in maintaining such funds?
Yes. Well, this question stems from the whole aspect of personal financial management and the prudent management of our personal hard-earned resources. And your question relates to the difference between a contingency fund and an emergency fund. These two are two very distinct forms of saving on the part of an individual to prudently manage their finances. When I say different, I mean both of them may have some. The common factor is that they're both used for the future, right? But differentiated in a very simple way. An emergency fund is basically a sum of money that is accumulated and only tapped into for unexpected expenditure. Anything unexpected, out of the ordinary. So it could be maybe an unexpected medical procedure, Allah forbid, or having to fork out a sum of money for a bumper bashing that was unexpected. But these are all examples of unexpected expenditures that can be that can be settled using one's emergency fund that has been set aside. In contrast to the emergency fund, a contingency fund is a fund or an accumulation of resources that is utilized for expenditure which the individual expects to incur in the near to medium term. So, example, someone is intending to do some home alterations, or there's a desperate need to change a motor vehicle towards something that will meet the needs more adequately, or there's some equipment required for, say, the children's homework, and then there's a computer of some sort. So the individual foresees this kind of expense, so in preparation for this expense, individual sets aside a sum of money. This is referred to as a contingency sum. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be a fancy product through a financial institution where an individual has an emergency fund or a contingency fund. I'm just referring to them as words, but could be in the form of hard-earned cash that an individual keeps at home, arguably unsafe, but individual would keep it in some form or the other. So that's basically the difference between an emergency fund and a contingency fund. I must add, Marana, in both circumstances, when an individual has either one or both of these kind of backup funds, it does provide, and there's no doubt about it, that it creates an element of peace of mind when the individual undergoes some kind of difficulty, simply because we live in a time where our level of conviction is weakened, it's waned, and we require, it's a natural aspect of life and being human beings in this world, that we require resources to fulfill our needs. And when unforeseen circumstances strike, then we do not want to be found wanting and begging or seeking assistance from others. Rather, we would prefer to be independent. So this is in keeping with the teachings of the Sharia to want to be independent and not a parasite in society. So that's basically, in a nutshell, the difference between an emergency fund and a contingency fund. I hope I've done justice to that part of your question. The second part of your question relates to the tips that can be offered to maintain these type of funds. I'm not too sure if there's anything to contribute from your end. If you can just allow me to just take a sip of water here before I proceed.
Yes, you can do that. In the meantime, just to remind our listeners, you are listening to Money on Monday, The Conscious Consumer, with Mufti Mohammed Hafiji, who is from Jamiatul Ulama South Africa's Economics Desk, and Mufti Sahab is answering questions. So if you have any questions, any queries, you can SMS on WhatsApp on 072-786-1548. That is 072-786-1548. Jazakallah, Mufti Sahab. The second part of the question, you answered the first part, and now the second part, and basic tips that you offer in maintaining such funds.
Yes, the first tip I want to offer, Marana, is it may sound very counterintuitive, but let's take an example of an individual who has some debt that they have to settle. So they gradually paying off their debt, and the creditors are kind of lenient, and they've given some kind of leeway to pay it off in small tranches, right? So in this type of scenario where creditors have given some kind of respite and they're not demanding their full sum, their full due, in this kind of scenario, it may be worth considering rather allocating surplus funds towards building up that emergency fund or contingency fund instead of pumping everything towards the settling of debt. This is more, and I emphasize, the scenario where creditors have granted respite and they're not making a demand for their full due. In this type of scenario, it may be an option to consider allocating any surplus resources towards that emergency or contingency fund. And to do this, the second tip I want to offer is for individuals to consider utilizing their tax rebates, any bonus received from work, extra cash from a side hustle. Put all of those excess funds can be used to build up a nice emergency fund, which can be tapped into if and when necessary. The third tip I want to offer is that whenever there's a need to tap into that emergency fund, it should be made a priority to top it back up before the individual spends or anywhere else. So that top-up is important. If an individual in adverse circumstances had to tap into the emergency fund and had no other option to do so, it is important to undertake as a matter of priority to make sure that it's topped up so that the emergency fund is back to where it was for future use and reference. The other aspect I want to mention is that when keeping these emergency funds or contingency funds, it's important to keep it, I would say, a step away from the bank account. What I mean is step away from the bank account is that if it's left, if a contingency or emergency fund is left commingled within a normal one bank account, there's always a temptation to utilize the fund. And as a result, it will defeat the whole purpose of having saved for an emergency or contingency for that matter. So it's important to make sure that these funds are kept separately from one ordinary bank account that is utilized for day-to-day spending purposes. This will resist or eliminate the temptation to tap into the emergency fund. And as a last tip, I want to mention that a contribution to a contingency fund should form part of an individual's monthly spending budget and be funded each month as part of your living expenses. So just as when a person receives their salary, a portion is set aside for living expenses, in the same way, portion should be set aside for that contingency fund, those expenses which are expected to be incurred in the near to medium term. So these are just basic things that individuals can do to ensure that they build up an emergency fund or a contingency fund for that matter. As I mentioned, the difference between the two, and important to keep in mind that as a rule of thumb, the emergency fund is usually an individual's monthly expenses or monthly wage multiplied by 3. That is basically a rule of thumb to determine where does the cap commence when it comes to an emergency fund. Because the individual lives within their salary, supposedly so. So if you multiply the monthly salary by 3, that should be the size of the emergency fund.
Muftisab, we need to go for a break, but after a break, we are interested to listen to Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Disease Act, that is known as COIDA Act. We want some explanation regarding that. But before that, let's take this ad break, and when we return, inshallah, we discuss COIDA Act. 28 minutes to 10 o'clock. Welcome back to Radio Islam International. Muftisab, the next question we want to ask you is about the Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Disease Act. So can you tell us about the COIDA Act and explain its relevance to the listeners of Radio Islam International?
Indeed, I'll try my best, Moana. as you mentioned, Compensation for Occupational Injury and Disease Act is something that requires some kind of orientation around for the benefit of our listeners. Just to provide some kind of background or introduction, the Department of Labor issued a notice in March this year in which it included compensation for COVID-19 to those who could prove that they had contracted the disease at work. But the notice excluded domestic workers. Now, I must admit, Marana, I, for one individual, find it very hard to pinpoint when exactly did anyone contract the disease. It's really difficult to say who an individual contracted it from or where or how they contracted it. At best, it is speculation. But be that as it may, just to come back to the topic itself, the Gauteng High Court in Pretoria last year ruled the exclusion of domestic workers from the protection under COIDA is unconstitutional. So shortly after this move by the Gauteng High Court, a proposed draft amendment bill seeking to extend coverage to domestic workers under this particular aspect of or piece of legislation was debated. However, the bill has not yet been taken through the legislative process. Now, while the number of COVID-19 infections are soaring by the day in the country, unions are increasingly worried about the fact that more and more domestic workers could become infected in the workplace, yet still do not have protection against the coronavirus under the Compensation for Occupational Injury and Disease Act. So obviously unions are concerned about who would take responsibility when a domestic worker did fall ill due to COVID-19, given the fact that they are not yet lawfully covered under the Act. So some unions have launched an online petition for all South Africans to sign. These petitions seek to draw the attention of government and particularly the Office of the Labour Minister to urgently address all aspects regarding the recognition of domestic workers as full employees and who deserve protection under the Compensation for Occupational Injury and Disease Act. The unions obviously feel that the exclusion of domestic workers from claiming compensation has always been irrational and discriminatory. They say that as the pandemic continues and the infections continue to soar, it is now even more important that domestic workers are safeguarded under the Act. So unions are arguing that the government should finalize the legislative process of amending the Act so that it includes domestic workers who work in private households. Just from my side, Morana, I must add that if such a move were to materialize and such changes were to take effect, there would be a severe negative impact. And the first form of the negative impact would be in the sense that jobs will be lost. So as we know, many individuals depend on that domestic work that they do, and as a result of the fear that many households would undergo if they were to discover that their domestic workers are covered under the Act, and if the domestic worker can prove in some way that they contracted the virus home, then the employer would be responsible. Obviously, this would lead to many households actually letting go or sacrificing their domestic workers that they are very accustomed to. That's one aspect. The other aspect is it will naturally lead to a rise in the increase of employing foreign labor who are not even governed by any piece of legislation. As we may know, many of the foreigners in South Africa, foreign nationals, are not covered by these various pieces of legislation. As a result, many households who already may be doing this will just and continue to employ even more foreign nationals. And as a result, local South Africans would be left out even further. So the jobs catastrophe will be even worse if something like this were to materialize and if unions were to have their way. So this is just as a matter of interest for ordinary households who may be employing domestic workers to consider the impact of this piece of legislation and the possible changes which are abound.
Gee, jazakallah for that. 23 minutes to 10 o'clock. You are listening to Our Conscious Consumer. We move on further. Frisa, now for business for beginners, can you simplify what a negative interest rate is and why is it relevant for this point in time?
Well, I'm not... I suppose your question doesn't stem from a desire to condone or endorse interest as a form of, or as a function of an economy, but just to understand the prevailing system that we are in and the effect it has on our lives. And that is why we have Business for Beginners, to simplify supposedly complex aspects of the economy, break them down so that ordinary folk can comprehend and understand these aspects. And I suspect that's where your question stems from, in terms of negative interest rates, what they are, and why they are relevant for this point in time. So to respond to your question, just to give a simple example, ordinarily interest rates are often defined as the price paid to borrow money. So for example, if you were to borrow me 100 rand, I would not repay 100 rand in the interest-based system. I would be paying you 100 rand plus a percentage of interest. So when it comes to negative interest rates, what basically happens is in harsher economic times, people and businesses tend to hold on to their cash, which is happening right now. And this is why this aspect that you're questioning and probing is relevant for this point in time, where individuals are holding on to cash. Everyone is just holding on to cash and waiting for the economy team to improve. But this behavior can actually weaken the economy even further. And this is a very simple rationale, because the more you and I or individuals hold on to cash, we hold and we don't spend enough on fulfillment of our needs or on the procurement of goods and services. As a result, if you and I are spending less, obviously companies and service providers will have to cut jobs and cut basic employment. In the process, you'll find that in order to make sales, they find that they would want to drop prices and reduce prices, all of which reinforces people's fears. So giving people even more incentive to hoard now, because people think that prices are coming down, let's hold on to our cash. And we, spending slows even further. So when prices drop even further, there's another incentive for people to wait as prices fall even further. So you find more saving and hoarding and holding on to cash can result in slowing the economy to some extent. So what then happens is central banks then try to utilize as a last resort a negative interest rate, which is basically a fee and a levy for a penalty for hoarding cash. So if you were to have, the more reserves you were to have in a bank, the more that bank has to hold in reserve with the central bank. So the central bank would then so to say, punish the banks for holding such large reserves. And the banks would obviously not carry that burden on its own, but would transfer or transmit that fee onto ordinary depositors. So each one of us, as individuals accumulating and hoarding cash, holding onto cash, we would have to then pay banks or financial institutions for having additional resources and holding onto resources and not spending these resources. So this is, as a last resort, negative interest rates are usually adopted as a policy measure and tool by central banks. It becomes relevant because countries like Sweden, Japan, and probably even coming closer to the UK, some countries are now looking at this as an alternative. It's important to keep in mind that even for Islamic financial institutions, such a move would have a drastic impact and would really put to test the depth of the system that we profess to be an alternative mainstream system. So this is basically what negative interest rates mean. It doesn't necessarily mean a good thing from an Islamic ordinary layman's perspective. All it means is that it's a penalty for holding on to too much cash. If you think about it, even Islamic economists have argued that the purpose of money is to be spent and to be employed in productive avenues, and not to be hoarded and held onto. So the more people hold onto money, the more there should be penalties for holding onto money. Whereas if people spend and invest and put it towards profitable avenues, which will lead to growth of the economy, this is in keeping with an Islamic system of money and as a function within an economy. So that's, in a nutshell, what negative interest rates are and why they are relevant for this period in time.
Mufti Saab, we leave it at that. Inshallah, hopefully next week we continue and learn more from you, inshallah.
Inshallah. Jazakallah khair for having me, Mohan.
Jazakallah for availing yourself. That was Mufti Muhammad Hafiji from Mayfair West, who's also at Jamiatul Ulama South Africa's economics desk, and he was discussing with us the conscious consumer as well as business for beginners. Time right now is 17 minutes to 10 o'clock. We go for an ad break, and when we return, inshallah, we'll conclude the hour with Shafi Fiqh. Mufti Razin Baghdadi will be joining us, inshallah, discussing with us Shafi Fiqh. 9:45, quarter to 10. Welcome back to Radio Islam International for our final segment. And for our final segment, we cross over to Mufti Razin Baghdadi, who is a Shafi Mufti, who answers questions with regards to Shafi Mazhab. And in this last segment, we will ask him few questions with regards to Shafi Mazhab. So on the line, we have Mufti Razin Baghdadi. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, Mufti Saab. Jazakallah khairan for availing yourself. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reward you. How are you doing this evening?
Alhamdulillah,
I'm also very well, Jazakallah. Mufti Saab, regarding conditions of Salah, sometimes some of the rulings may differ compared to Imam Abu Hanifa rahmatullahi alayhi and Imam Shafi rahmatullahi alayhi. So what are the conditions of Salah according to Imam Shafi rahmatullahi alayhi?
Jima, I think it's important now and again that even though we might know these various conditions of Salah, but sometimes it is good for us to go through them again to refresh our memory. And sometimes there are some of us who might not be aware of these types of shurut and conditions. And when we talk about conditions, we are talking about those things which need to be done prior to Salah and not the conditions within Salah itself. So here we are talking more about the prerequisites of Salah. So when it comes to the prerequisites of Salah, there are four prerequisites of salah according to the Shafi madhab. Inshallah, we'll try and cover the first two. But if you can just go over all of them briefly. Firstly is cleanliness. The second being the entering of the time of that particular salah. The third being the covering of the awra. And the fourth being to face the qibla. So inshallah, this week we will concentrate on the first two, which is cleanliness and entering of the time of salah. And inshallah, in our next program next week, inshallah, we'll cover the other two. So when it comes to cleanliness, first of all, there are different types of cleanliness as we have discussed when we discussed the masail of tahara. So one, the first form of cleanliness is tahara from ritual impurity, or as we, the Arabic term is known as hadath, tahara from all types of hadath. And hadath is that abject state that one is in, where one is then required to either make wudu or ghusl. So if a person needs to make wudu, he has to ensure that he has to have wudu for performing salah. Likewise, if he's in the state of janabah, then it is necessary for him to perform ghusl before performing salah. So that was the first type of tahara, tahara from ritual impurity. Thereafter, we have tahara of the body from all types of physical najasa. So physical types of najasa would include your urine, your stool, blood, pus, all these type of impurities. The body needs to be completely free from it. So one is the body, and then the third type of tahara is the tahara of the clothing. So one is your body must be free from these type of najasa, but that's not only restricted to the body. One's clothing as well needs to be free from all these types of najasa. And now the fourth type of tahara, the fourth type of cleanliness is the place where one is going to offer his or her salah also needs to be tahir. So what happens is maybe we are on a journey and we might not have a musalla or a sheet or a maybe a scarf or something to perform our salah on, then we are allowed to make it on the ground. However, it should be noted that when we are making salah on the ground, the area where our body is going to touch whilst we are performing salah, that area needs to be free from any type of najasa. So the place where we're going to place our hands, the place where we're going to place our forehead and nose, our knees, and how the area where we are going to sit in tashahud, all those areas need to be free from any type of najasa. However, the space that's in between that, so if you're going into sajda, for example, there is a gap between the hands and the knees. If there is a form of najasa, maybe there's bird droppings or any other form of najasa that might be present on that area, as long as it's within that space there where the body is not going to touch during sujood, then it is fine. A person will still be able to perform salah in that area. The second condition is the entering of the time. We need to make sure, obviously, that the time for that particular salah has already entered. If we find out that we had performed the salah but the time has not yet entered, then we are going to have to repeat our salah. And obviously, the ways of ensuring that the time has entered, this can be done by physical evidence. Generally, today we have the good fortune of having our calendars which are out, so it makes it easier for us to identify the time of salah. But sometimes, if you don't have your calendar, then we look at the sun and the different positions of the sun to get an idea of whether that time has set in. And then obviously if it's a cloudy day, obviously then you will have to use your estimation because the sun would not be able to help you in that regard. So inshallah, we'll suffice on those two for this week. Ma, inshallah, next week we'll continue with the other two, inshallah.
Jazakallah for mentioning the first two. Moving on further, the next question that we have for you, Mufti Sab, is could you assist us by telling us the correct method of ghusl for both males and females? Again, this is for those that follow Imam Shafi, rahmatullahi alayh.
When it comes to the performing of ghusl, there isn't much of a difference in terms of the madahib, but we will just go through them just to make sure that we are able to perform our ghusl, including the sunan as well. So when a person wants to perform ghusl, then we should first start off by reciting Bismillah and then making the intention of ghusl. And in our intention, we should have in mind or keep in mind that we are trying to remove all impurities and we are also performing the ghusl to become pure for any specific ibadah. So if it's for salah or reciting the Quran or to enter the masjid, we should have that niyyah as well in mind. After making the niyyah, we should remove any form of impurities that are found on the body. After that, we should make wudu, and this wudu is the same like that for the wudu of salah. And once that is done, we should take water and pass it over all the areas of the body where it might be difficult for water to reach on its own. So if you look at the inner part of the ear, if we have a bit of excess stomach, then within the rolls of the stomach, or maybe in the navel area, the buttock region, all those areas where if one just has to pour water, there is fear that the water might not reach within those gaps and cavities, then it is sunnah to actually make sure, rather it is necessary for you to make sure that the water reaches those areas. After doing that, the person should then pour water over the head and run his fingers through the hair, making sure that the water reaches every part of the skin that is under the hair. And thereafter, a person should then go to the right side of his body, doing the same thing, making sure the water is reaching every part of the body, every inch of every millimeter of the body is the water is reaching every millimeter of the body. And likewise, the same thing will be done for the left-hand side. And it is sunnah to actually rub one's hands over the body to ensure that the water reaches all these places. And to pass water over the entire body three times is also a sunnah. When it comes to the female's manner, the process is the same. However, if a woman has her hair plaited, then it will only be necessary for her to remove the plaits if the plaits prevent the water from reaching under it. If it doesn't prevent the water from reaching under the plaits, then it's fine. They do not have to take out the plaits.
Jazakallah for explaining that in detail. The third question that we have is, what's the latest, as in late time, one can read the Maghrib Salah?
Okay, so when it comes to Maghrib Salah, the time for Maghrib Salah begins when the sun has completely set, and that time extends right up until the redness in the sky can no longer be seen. Generally, for those of us who stay in a urban area, in a city, where it is difficult for us to see the horizon, this for us it might appear to actually be like for more or less half an hour to 45 minutes, but the time for that day actually extends to a little later than the day as well. The exact time can be better seen if a person is more on the outskirts where the horizon isn't affected by the city light. Nonetheless, when there is the complete redness disappears from the sky, then the time of Maghrib has now concluded, and a person won't be able to perform his Maghrib Salah, and the time of Isha Salah would have set in.
Next question we have is that kindly provide us with information on the number of Sunnah Rakats before and after each Fard Salah. This will be highly appreciated, once again, according to Imam Shafi, rahmatullahi alayh.
Okay. So when it comes to the Sunnah Salah, we know we have Sunnah Mu'akkara and Sunnah Ghair Mu'akkara. There are 10 rakats which are considered Sunnah Mu'akkara with regards to the 5 salawat. This is excluding the Witr Salah. So these 10 rakats are the 2 rakats before Fajr, the 2 rakats before Dhuhr, and the 2 rakats after Dhuhr, the 2 rakats after Maghrib, and the 2 rakats after Isha. So these are considered to be our Sunnah Mu'akkara. Excluding the Witr Salah, that is also considered to be a Sunnah Mu'akkada. And when it comes to the Sunnah Ghair Mu'akkada, there are 8 rakats. And Sunnah Ghair Mu'akkada are performed, 2 of them are performed before Dhuhr, and 2 of them are performed after Dhuhr, and 4 of them are performed before Asr. There are also two other rakats which are also considered to be Sunnah, Sunnah Ghair Mu'akkada in particular, and that is the 2 rakats before the Maghrib Salah, meaning after the Adhan. If there is time, then one should try and read these 2 rakats. However, if there isn't time, and generally in our masajid, immediately after the Maghrib Adhan is given, then the Jamaat stands up for the Maghrib Salah. So in such a case, in such an instance, there is no time for a person to perform these 2 rakats of Sunnah Ghair Mu'akkada. So instead of performing these rakats, one should rather join the Jamaat, and if he wants to perform it as a qadha later on, then he can do it, as it is mustahab to perform qadha of a sunnah which one has missed.
Mufti Sahib, with regards to zakah, is it true that zakah is necessary on the wealth of a minor also, according to Imam Shafi, rahmatullahi alayh?
Ajima, that is correct. If a minor has any wealth which is equal to the nisab, the minor child's possession, for an entire lunar year, it will be necessary for the parent or their guardian to discharge this account on their behalf. Thus, mana also refers to a person who is mentally challenged, and there is someone who is taking over or looking to their affairs and looking to their wealth. For that person also, it's necessary for them to take out zakah on their wealth. And Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam has mentioned in this regard that we should invest the wealth of our minors so that zakah does not eventually eat it up all away. So as parents or as guardians, we should see how we can invest our dependents' money in a way which will be profitable for them and in a way which will benefit them. And we should also not delay when it comes to the discharging of the zakah. We should be punctual on it, keep a note of it, and make sure we discharge it on time.
Gee, Jazakallah. Finally, before we move on to Imam Shafi, rahmatullahi alayhi's poetry, one more question with regards to zakat. Do Shafi's pay zakat on Kruger rents?
Before answering that, a few scenarios you might have. One is you might have one Kruger rent, or maybe we have more than one Kruger rent. The other is you have Kruger in with other forms of jewelry or other form of gold, which is zakatable. So if a person just has one Kruger in terms of grams, it comes out to about 33 grams, more or less 33 grams. And the nisab for gold is 84.8 grams, according to the Shafi Madhab. So if a person just has one Kruger in, a zakah will not become necessary. Even if a person has two Kruger in, it could be about 66 grams of gold. So zakah still will not be necessary. However, if they have three Kruger rands or more, then zakah will become necessary. But that is only if we are talking about Kruger rands specifically. If a person has one Kruger rand, but he or she has other jewelry as well, and the combined weight of that jewelry and the, rather not jewelry, gold or any other gold jewelry which is kept for investment purposes, then if the combined weight of the Kruger rand with that gold that that person has comes to 84.8 grams, then zakah will be necessary on it.
Now, finally, as we have 2 minutes left, Mufti Sab, can we end with some poetry of Imam Shafi, rahmatullahi alayh?
Jima, I came across another very beautiful poem, this time dealing with friends. And Imam Shafi in this couplet talks about qualities which he would like to see in a friend and which are difficult to find in friends, actually. And it's also a lesson for us that one is we want to have good friends, and one is we need to be a good friend. So what are the qualities that we need to have in ourselves that will make us good friends as well? Imam Shafi rahimahullah mentioned, أُحِبُّ مِنَ الْإِخْوَانِ كُلَّ مُوَاتِي وَكُلَّ غَضِيرِ الطَّرْفِ عَنْ عَثَرَاتِي يُوَافِقُنِي فِي كُلِّ أَمْرٍ أُرِيدُهُ وَيَحْفَظُنِي حَيًّا وَبَعْدَ مَمَاتِي فَمَنْ لِي بِهَذَا لَيْتَ أَنِّي أَصَبْتُهُ لَقَاسَمْتُهُ مَالِي مِنَ الْحَسَنَاتِ تصفحت إخواني فكان أقلهم على كثرة الإخوان أهل ثقاتي. Imam Shafi mentions that I love and honor my friends who agree and are pleasant with me. And every friend who is able to turn a dry eye from the mistakes that are present within me. Such a friend who will offer me a word of encouragement or a helping hand in any matter I intend. Not only that, but he protects my honor whilst I am alive and even after I have met my end. Who can bring me such a friend? If only I could find one with such qualities, I would have given him all my boons and bounties. I page, I'm paraphrasing with regards to this last couplet, mm-hmm. I page and scroll through the list of my friends on Facebook and Instagram. Mm-hmm. However, even though there are many, very few are those whom I can consider as trustworthy.
Subhanallah, mashallah. Jazakallah khair, Mufti Razin Baghdadi. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reward you. Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Time right now is exactly 10 o'clock. We say Jazakallah khairan for tuning in to Radio Islam International for our weekly Fiqh Q&A program. From myself, Suhaib Lasania, and my engineer, Hafiz Mahmood. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.